Today we talk with Diana Sheets about her new novel, The Cusp of Dreams. The book is a collection of fictional short stories set in the cutthroat world of corporate America. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Mindy. It's nice to be here.
Now, are the stories and the characters in the book based on your experience in corporate sales in New York?
Well, they always say that the first novel that you write comes closely from your experience. So, yes, I worked in corporate sales for 12 years in the metropolitan New York area. I worked for Ameritech, which is one of the seven regional Bell companies. And what I was struck by when I was trained as a historian and when I was working in the company, I realized that many of the people that we were using in the sales force did not have a living wage. And I was struck by what happens to people who don't know how to get up in the morning and aren't earning a living wage. And the stories seemed to me very powerful. Mm-hmm. So obviously it's fictionalized, but it's meant to be, a very powerful portrayal of the workplace today.
Yeah. You write, sales is war, plain and simple. And no one fighting in those trenches gives a damn about sexual harassment policies or fair allocations of territory. It took me a while to learn the underlying rules, the ones people live and die by.
Yeah, that's correct. I think the contrast, if you look at all of the other more feminized businesses, they try to live by the rules of the workplace. Sales is our id, our subliminal drives and impulses, and it's up until recently it's been very male dominated. Mm-hmm. So the rules of men in warfare really apply, and the women who tended to gravitate, particularly for corporate sales, tended to become like the men in order to win or survive in the marketplace.
Yeah, let's go to that point. The women in the book, just as ruthless as the men. And so how do men and women differ in the corporate workplace, or do they?
Well, I'm trying to upend certain notions about how women behave in the workplace. I think one of the last taboos in fiction is that women are necessarily more empathetic and caring and generous, and by implication, especially for a feminized readers, better people. And what I'm arguing is that if you're in a cutthroat world of business, it's every person fighting for survival. And although some of the behaviors might differ, women who want to survive and succeed become every bit as ruthless as their male counterparts.
Yeah. And sometimes we see a woman like that who's, you know, strong and in that corporate kind of position, there might be some who would label her a witch because we can't say the other word on the air, where men have they're more admired for it.
Well, yes, and women aren't allowed to play that game. But Carly Fiorani, who is running in California, I mean, I think she embodies that new type of woman who's used to playing in the trenches, used to playing a man's game, plays by the men's rules. And I think that if you want to be powerful, if you want to succeed, you live by those rules. Mm.
Now, your stories show the grittier side, sort of the dog-eat-dog reality of corporate sales. These are not happy stories. And I wonder what kind of reaction the book is getting from people in that line of work. Are they saying, wow, you're right on? Or are they saying, oh, you're only showing one side? What would they say?
Well, my complaint with literature is that I think for a long time it's moved away from realism and, for me, naturalism, which is the sort of lurid sense of our bestial selves. And when we are sliding down the economic ladder, I think that very harsh realities emerge. And so the question is, if you want fiction to be meaningful, if you want it to say something important about what's happening to us in the way we live today, then it's really obligated to tell these terrible stories.
Yeah. Now, some might compare your book to Arthur Miller's Death of a Salesman. What is your opinion of the American dream and its impact on society?
One of the things, I was inspired to write this because of Death of a Salesman and David Mamet's Glengarry Glen Ross. And what I was, what I felt is that Death of a Salesman was the personal failure of Willie Loman, whereas Glengarry Glen Ross was a societal failure. Every individual in the real estate office is vicious and cutthroat. But what had been forgotten was the role of women. There were no women in the social landscape. So I felt the last taboo of fiction is having women behave every bit as venally as men. And I felt that this was long overdue to have women as central characters in the workplace.
Now, The Cusp of Dreams suggests someone who just came up short, just failed to make it. None of your characters really achieve their dreams, that end goal, if you will. We find the main character Sue still going for it. Even at the end, she's still her dream has changed somewhat, but she's still going for it. But when you look at what she's lost along the way, you kind of ask yourself, is it really worth it? And I'm imagining that's a question you want people to ponder.
Right. And I've deliberately, Sue is pursuing the American dream, and in the end, she's sacrificed her husband, who she loved very much. All the material attributes are gone. She's living in Silicon Valley. She owns nothing. But I've really left it hanging whether she's going to achieve her dreams or end up with absolutely nothing, or maybe just keep picking herself up and struggling all the way. So I've called this The Cusp of Dreams a novel. It's tragedy with shards of comedy. Mm-hmm. Comedy is what keeps us reading, and there's a variety of ways you can laugh at the predicament of human society. But it's a very painful look at who we are and what we are becoming. Mm.
Diana Sheets, her book is The Cusp of Dreams. An essay you wrote, The Decline of the Great Books, you talk about the cultural decline. The same theme appears in your book. Do you see our culture in general as on the decline?
Well, I think we're fighting for our survival. I think I'm trained as a historian, and British history is my area. And one of the things I was struck by, if you look at Britain in the late 1880s and early 20th century, once you lose manufacturing, Britain thought it could manage a global empire based on just expertise without any real skill, just managing money, basically. And it proved to be a very tragic mistake. And I really feel we've done the same thing. Our manufacturing has been ceded to China. And I think that's and so what I'm writing about in this novel is about the death of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And I think that a country that no longer produces its own goods is not only decadent, but it's going to have a hard time winning in the global marketplace.
Yeah. A lot of stories start out with hope and promise and then end in despair. Is this a subtle criticism of our country's cultural fate?
We're in very challenging times, and the question is, can we rise, like Sue in the last chapter, out of the ashes of the phoenix? Can we rise again? And who will? What are we becoming as we metamorphize into the new this new virtual reality with virtual products? And I don't know. I think what worries me is I think our education is declining. I think our values are not as good as they used to be. I don't think we really know how to face adversity, and I fear that we don't know how to win under those circumstances. And right now, certainly, China is making a very compelling case for the new ascendancy. And as an American, I hope that we still remain global competitors in the workplace. And I worry that if we're not, these stories will become the reality for many, many Americans.
I think some of these stories are reality.
I agree.
I mean, reading them, you can see shades of people you know in some of these stories. And I can't help but think of the first story is such a sad story. This is about a fellow who's really desperate for this job, and Sue doesn't want to hire him. She's really kind of trying to find something in him to give me a bone here, give me something that I can, say, okay, you're worth hiring. And, she spends 2 hours with him, and she does end up hiring him, but not because she wants to, but more because she has to.
Yes. And what's terribly sad, you don't know whether this Bill, in the end, he dies, but does he die because he's just physically ill, or does he choose to die because he can no longer support his family? Mm. And one of the questions I raise, and Sue is younger and more aggressive, and you have the sense of that she's a winner. Mm-hmm. But by the end of the novel, she's thinking more and more about Bill, and she can't help escaping the fact that maybe she's more like Bill than she ever admitted.
Right.
And, you know, I think when we're young, we always think that we can prevail. And as times get more tough, the question is, what are we going to do to try to remain on top? And can we remain human beings when we're all fighting for survival?
Right. And there's a lot of desperation on many of the characters here. You have Bill, who's desperate for that job. You have Candy, desperate for male attention, especially from Hugh. You have Richard, desperate for Sue's job. Talk about the desperation many of the characters have.
Well, Richard is a great character. He's extraordinarily charismatic, very masculine, and he tries to seize Sue's job, and he's got a really fantastic poker game going in his apartment in New York. And so he's a very vital character. And the question is, how does a woman overcome someone like that, who's playing all the men's games, and she has to play by her own rule book? So he's a very compelling character, but I think there's a lot of comedy in Pain. Mm-hmm. And I think even though they're struggling, there is many, many ways to look at. We're all going through difficult times. We all have to pick ourselves up. But if you can find the humor, it makes it easier to pick yourself up and go on.
Yeah, so. And the I guess character of a person who's in sales. You have to have you have to be a strong person. You have to not be afraid of people and afraid to sell, basically. So it takes a certain personality. And many of your characters, I think of kind of as what the stereotypical salesperson would be. You know, they're good looking, they're charming. Not all of them, but there's this sort of a characteristic that they have. And yet you also bring out that other side that I guess you don't, like when you're young and like Sue coming up, mm-hmm. I don't think she thinks too much about betrayal, but it's at every corner.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think it is in the workplace. I think when you're young and naive, you want to think that everybody gets along and everything's going to be good. But the workplace is a place of war. It's a place where you win and you lose. And as jobs become more and more scarce, this is the world that we inhabit. And in a way, novels stop telling us anything meaningful about the world. If people want to understand what the world of business is like today, The Cusp of Dreams really, really drives home how treacherous and difficult and challenging it is, and what it means to survive in the economic workplace. And I hope your listeners will take a look at it, because it tells us just who we are and what we are becoming.
Well, and the workforce is changing. I mean, obviously, mm-hmm. at one time we didn't have women in the leadership role. So we have Sue, who is the manager, not the top, but she's up there. Also, we used to have people who stayed with the same job. You know, when you went to work somewhere, you worked there your whatever years, you got your gold watch, and you went home. And that is just not the case anymore.
No,
whole workforce has changed.
It's really very, actually, it's very terrifying. My father was in business. Everybody in my family has been in the working world, and it's just been. And when I go back and talk to former colleagues, my last job was working for Xerox in Manhattan, and there's just one downsizing after another. My sister is working for HP, and it was DEC earlier, and it's just unbelievable to see how many times and how many people can get laid off and how people have to struggle to survive. And really, the terrible things that happen when middle-aged people who've been doing a good job are laid mm-hmm. off. And in a way, it's surprising that the people still manage to maintain their humanity. I mean, mm-hmm. I think of the movie Falling Down, which really powerfully conveyed, Michael Douglas mm-hmm. was in that, what it's like for an ordinary American to lose his job and what happens to mm-hmm. somebody in that social landscape.
Well, and that happens in the book. We have people who are doing very good jobs, and we have some who are not. We have people who are fired and who deserve to be fired. And then we have people who have done everything they're supposed to do, and this downsizing happens. And it was interesting to me when Sue has to let go of her people in her division, the ones that were doing a good job, when they decide to close that division, the anger they had towards Sue. not the company, but like it was her personally who
Well, Sue is the face of the company. And what was very frightening to me to discover, and they talk a little bit about this in Walter Kern's Up in the Air, although the Walter Kern's book really doesn't convey it. They brought in someone who was an expert in downsizing for the film that really brought it home. In some of these places, they're firing you, and it's not even an employee that's firing you, and it's in a white room, and they have medics on standby and armed guards. So the corporation doesn't even have the courage to have a face-to-face look at the employees that they're downsizing. And keep in mind, at the upper levels of the company, they never feel the pain. It's always the first and second line managers. And you harden yourself, but you're not alive if you don't peel some of the pain. So the irony in The Cusp of Dreams is Sue is always being very critical about herself, but her employees. But at the very end, she's hopeful that they can actually win, and they come this close. Mm-hmm. And so it's particularly painful for her because she has to lay people off that she really believed that could have succeeded and made the company successful.
Now, one of the other things here is I'm thinking of the women characters in the book. There doesn't seem to be any healthy female friendships, with the exception of Mir. There was a really good friendship, and Mir was one of Sue's reps. They got very close. She bonded with her instantly, and Mir did a good job. And there's a betrayal that happens, and their friendship ends. But the other ones, I thought, wow. Candy, for example,
right,
who appears to be Sue's friend, but would stab her in the back in a second.
And I think with Mir, I wanted to ask the question, can you be more moral if you have some money and therefore you can play by a higher set of rules? I at least wanted to raise the question whether that was the source of Mare's integrity. Candy and Mir and Sue all come from a slightly higher social class than some of the ordinary workers, and so they have a different worldview. Mir is really almost a noble character, and Skip, who's a terrible failure, is in some sense a noble character. But Candy is the quintessential woman in the workplace who is almost a sociopath. She knows how to play the game. She's attractive.
And she uses that.
And she uses that as a card. And that type of character is out there. Mm-hmm. And I also wanted to explore something with Mir and Sue. It's I don't like labels, so I don't want to call it a lesbian relationship or something.
Doesn't
like
go
that.
Quite that far.
No, but it's about intimacy, and it's about love and affection and the bonds of deep, deep abiding bonds of women, and what happens when the workplace destroys those bonds.
Yeah. There is a good friendship though between Sue and Skip.
And it's interesting because in many ways Skip is a failure, but in some ways he's a noble failure. His Southern heritage, in a way, despite all the tragedies in his life, gives him almost a heroic honor, and he has a civility that's been gone in the workplace. And Sue can't help admiring that and rooting for him, even though his life and he's one of the few that's still married with his family.
Right.
You know, I think in sales and writers and actors, they're the most destabilizing groups that we have in society. They're loners at heart, and marriages have troubles.
There's a lot of temptation when you're on the road, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, one of the things that I found interesting was Lori. Lori, she's just bad seed all the way around. But Lori is she knows she's going to be fired, and so she has this desperate effort to keep her job by filing a sexual harassment suit.
Right.
And she is extremely devious in trying to create, she's obviously been working at this for some time, create this evidence, so-called evidence, for herself. And that, she drags Skip into it. Poor Skip.
Yep. Poor Skip, who didn't even know what he was getting into. But I think, again, these are the characters, these are the circumstances of the workplace. Not every sexual harassment suit is legitimate, which is not to minimize them, I think, obviously.
That certainly exists, yeah.
Right, and the overwhelming numbers are real. But for someone who's desperate to keep her job and doesn't know how to do it, it's another playing card in the game of work warfare. And Rita is really a more interesting character. They're almost Rita and Lori are almost bonded together. They're almost fused. And Rita looks like a wonderful woman. She looks like the most caring person you'd want. But in many ways, she's every bit as destructive as Laurie. She's destroying her family. Gambling has taken over her life. It's the great passion of her life. Her child her daughter may or may not be abused by her husband. And so I found her a really interesting character because in many ways you really empathize with her, you like her, you admire her, but she's corrosive every bit as much as Laurie is. We all recognize Laurie as being evil through and through, but Rita is a more interesting case.
And the interesting thing about that is the position Sue is put in, where Laurie is making all kinds of accusations about Rita's husband.
Yeah.
But when Sue talks to Rita, Rita doesn't let on any of that. And as a manager, your hands are kind of tied. So as much as Sue cares and would like to help, she really can't do anything.
No, she can't. And again, Rita's relationship with her husband is very complex. At first, Sue thinks that it's Jake is the evil one, but she realizes later on that this is a very, very complicated family dynamic. And there are, in a sense, no heroes and in an absolute sense, maybe even no villains.
Right. Now, there's a bit of fraud. And, you know, just thinking of the headlines we have in the business world now, it doesn't seem so much of a stretch, but I'm thinking, how does this happen? I mean, did you experience something like that in your real corporate dealings, or is this something that's totally fiction?
No, you experience fraud at many levels, on personal levels where people can no longer succeed. They'll do anything to survive. The last corporate job I had was with Xerox in Manhattan, and we were selling locomotive printing systems in a city that didn't need them. The locomotive printing was done in Kansas more likely than New York. And, the last account I had, they wanted me to sign off and it wasn't a valid deal. And I refused to do it. And in the end, somebody signed it because they had numbers to meet and the numbers went through and the order was going to have to be backed out. Afterward, there was a number of lawsuits that went through with Xerox. And I think the enormous demand to have double-digit growth, no matter what the circumstances, and when you're dealing with manufacturing and it's a mature industry, 3% growth is normal. Mm-hmm. So what do you do when the very, very top management want to meet their quotas and nobody wants to go down the fire line?
Right.
And it gets slipperier and slipperier, and then finally there's some moral abyss that decisions have to make.
Well, and I think the numbers, you know, they set the goals, and they're unattainable, and they're always unattainable.
Yep.
And I think everybody can relate to that. Like, that's unattainable. Yet we set these goals and kind of set ourselves up for failure.
And it makes you sick. I mean, if you have any ethical grounding, I mean, when I went into sales in the early 80s, I found it exciting. And I was working with manufacturing companies. I was designing their advertising. And these were the last great individuals, the owners of these small to mid-sized manufacturing companies. They were heroes. And incidentally, they were conservative. They were conservative because they were trying to save and create their business and pass it on to successive generations. They were the most individual success stories that I had seen in my adult. But by the end, in corporate America, as part of big institutions, I'm seeing these numbers that just can't be met. And New York is a particularly hard place to survive in the corporate landscape because the demands and the pressure to bring the price down to below profit margins makes people behave in very adversarial ways.
Now, you also write political commentaries and literary criticism. So how does that relate to your fiction?
This book was completed in 2000, and I had a Harvard-educated agent to represent the book, and it was being represented right after 9/11, and you couldn't have had
tough
a worse time,
yeah.
But really, what I'm seeing in terms of reading patterns is we really stopped reading at that point. The internet took over reality. The figures on young people in reading is just devastating. And I wanted to ask myself, you know, in this, I have a second novel that will be coming out this fall, and it's a send up of Chick Lit, and it's sort of the opposite of The Cusp of Dreams. It's comedy with pain instead of a tragedy with shards of humor. But and I got a Columbia educated agent to represent it. He loves the mother, and so says she's this great Jewish mother. But I wasn't able to. You know, I was having trouble placing these novels, and so I had to ask why. Why is it that very compelling fiction that's getting some very, very bright, capable agents can't sell in the marketplace? And one of the conclusions that I came to is that fiction has become feminized. That's not feminism. Feminized means it has become a virtue world of women who want to feel good about themselves and how moral they are. It's a land filled with women and children, and it's turned its back on the world. But if you want to say anything interesting about the world, it's not this fictional world of a feminized universe. It's very ugly things are happening, and if you want to sort of see where we're going, you need to write about these things. So I ended up having a lot of understanding, empathy, sympathy for realism, especially naturalism, and I concluded that the drive toward feminization was really killing fiction, and I had to write about this. So I put – there are a bunch of essays on my website, Literary Gulag, that talk about the consequences of a loss of, dare I say it, manliness and virility in the fictional novel. I mean, men are no longer reading fiction. They're mostly not reading at all, but if they're reading anything, it's technical and it's nonfiction. And if we want our stories to be vital and tell us something about the world, we have to reengage manliness and reengage the male reader.
Yeah, I was just thinking, my husband is a reader and he reads fiction.
He's unusual.
And so your website is?
It's Literary Gulag. My argument is that I'm in the gulag, and only in the gulag do you have the freedom to tell the truth.
Ah. And so when you write these criticisms, is it just, I mean, is it across, do you review certain books or trends?
For instance, I do a searing attack on Ian McEwan's fiction, which I feel is very feminized. I celebrate Norman Mailer. I celebrate Tom Wolfe. Who were devalued because literary writers felt they were writing about the world.
Right. The book is The Cusp of Dreams. Diana Sheets, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Mindy. I really appreciate it.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thank you for listening.
The Point is hosted and produced by Mindy Todd. The executive producer is Steve Young. Production assistance from Dan Treidel and Jenny Jenker. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH Radio.